The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future, with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. Ian Watt is Reynolds Professor of Humanities at Stanford University. Professor Watt is a native of Westmoreland, England. He was educated in Dover and at St. John's College of Cambridge University. He served in the British Army during World War II and was a prisoner of war in the Far East between 1942 and 1945. Professor Watt has taught at St. John's College, Cambridge, at the University of California at Berkeley, the University of East Anglia, and he's been at Stanford since 1964. Dr. Watt's writing includes work on the novelists Defoe, Richardson, Fielding, Hardy, and Conrad. His book, The Rise of the Novel, is widely acknowledged as a landmark in the scholarship and criticism of the modern novel. Professor Watt has also edited several casebooks and critical guides to writers of the 19th and 20th centuries. He's written numerous articles and reviews. The University of California Press has recently released Professor Watt's book, Conrad in the 19th Century, which will soon be followed by a companion volume on Conrad. Joining in the discussion is Kent Mulliken, the Assistant Director of the National Humanities Center. Professor Watt, it's a pleasure to have you visit the center, and welcome to our radio program, Soundings. Let's begin by discussing some recent fiction. Some critics have charged that the novel is dead. Do you think that's true?
No, I don't think so. I think there's all kinds of reasons why there has been less cohesion in literary movements over the last 20, 30 years. But I think you could say the same of almost every feature of international life and the culture as a whole. Let's say that all kinds of things are more fragmented and I don't think anything like the great movement of modernism that's associated with Conrad, Joyce, Virginia Woolf. There has been nothing like that since. So to that extent, one can say, there really was a great rise at one period and that it's not been repeated. But on the other hand, I can't believe that the interest in the novel doesn't continue, and that our life is finding its recorders in all kinds of ways still.
Your famous book on the rise of the novel dealt with the very early emergence of novel writing and a popular audience, which stimulated the writing of novels. Mm-hmm. It seems to me a big jump from the 18th century novel to Joseph Conrad. Could you say a little bit about how the two are linked in your scholarly life?
Well, I don't think that they are linked in any direct sense. I'd say there's many other things I would like to have written about other than the 18th century novel and Conrad. I certainly think that one element in my approach to both the books is the same, and that is that trying to understand a society as a whole as represented and as influencing the literary product.
How would you assess the status of the novel today?
Well, what I mean is that if you talked to a university audience 30 or 40 years ago, you would tend to find the same few names recurring more than they do now. That, for example, my impression is that Saul Bellow, for example, is a more divisive figure, that say certain younger groups resent his hegemony, if it is that. Opinions about Mailer, you know, was also, in my view, an enormous talent, are even more divided, I think. And among all kinds of age and political and mm-hmm. other grounds.
You mentioned Norman Mailer. Let's pause on that for a moment. What's your opinion of the tendency to mix fact and fiction in writing today, popular writing? Is that a dangerous thing?
No, I don't think it's dangerous. Insofar as I'm popularly associated with the notion of realism, I don't really think my tastes are very narrow, but I mean, this is, a lot of people think it is. It seems to me to be a wholesome sense of, well, things have got to be so crazy in the fantasy line, or all literature is just a game line, that the corrective of getting back to the idea that you can't tell whether something is real or fictional, which we've had in many kinds of writing, seems to me to be a reflection of one really important thing that the novel can do. And whether you're going a little in the direction of fictionalizing history, or whether you're going in the direction of really not letting your reader know how far the novel is in fact history, which I think, I'm not an authority on it, but Rag Times would seem to me to be an example of a very popular work which depended upon giving the people the sense that this was really what it was like in those days, and all these things that we think of as typical of today were in some form going on in the early 20th century. That seems to me the people who read it, I think, responded to the idea of this is really like what things were like then. And it seems to me to be extraordinarily well written as a novel, given that objective.
Mm-hmm. Professor Watt, you're in the midst of a large study of Joseph Conrad, and you've published the first volume of Conrad in the 19th century, and very interested in what makes Joseph Conrad an essentially modern writer. How does he speak to this century?
I think there would be two things I would say. One is, if you think about Conrad the man, in my first volume, I suggest that there were, in all kinds of ways, having been an orphan, having been a prisoner of the Russian imperial tyranny, having then been an exile, gave him a sense of rootlessness, of the intractable conditions of history, which not many people in England or France conceived of till the First, or possibly even the Second World War, so that he looked at the world in a way that has, I think, come into its own much more in the Second World War, so that his experience gave him that, and I think it was natural that those early 40 years of his life, before he became a writer, is what may explain why his earlier works, such as Heart of Darkness, have this element of modernity, why it's only, I mean, as it were, every year something happens that makes Conrad seem very topical. I mean, witness the movie. But then, in his own way of seeing things, as a writer, I think one can see that he, because he didn't take anything for granted, in which it's very much, I suppose, what we notice in many other fields of enterprise today in which there is no absolute truth, but this is how it seemed to X and this is how it seemed to Y, and we leave it to the reader to decide how much of the reality either of them saw or on how what other realities we can add to what the novel gives us. So I think there's a sort of technical aspect as well as the topicality of Conrad's experience in the middle of the 19th century was such as is fairly close to duplicating what a lot of people's experience has been as a result of the First and the Second World War. And I've just come back from Poland, and it's because it's very striking how Conrad has grown more and more the dominant figure in conversation and thought there.
You just mentioned the use of Conrad in a recent movie, mm-hmm. Francis Ford Coppola's movie about Vietnam. I wonder if you could comment on the moral element in Conrad's fiction.
Of course, I don't. I think it was a terrible movie, and I think it, among other things, misrepresented Conrad in this very issue. That say that Conrad was somebody who had experience of something that you can call apocalypse. Let's say he'd lived in a country with a great history which had ceased to exist. For the first 30 years of his life, he had no idea of what the future would bring him. So much of his own family and country had in fact been destroyed, and he had no idea that Poland would live again. So that one might have thought he had was an apocalyptic writer, but not at all. Even Heart of Darkness, his emphasis is on Marlowe and how seeing these horrors only make you more cautious in your assertions of how you can navigate among these perils. Let's say it's not at all everything is blowing up. Man's effort to survive and man's effort to understand go on in a way which I don't think the movie suggested.
I'm interested in a point you've made in your recent book about the curious tension in Conrad's book between his loyalty to the everyday life of fact, the realistic strain in Conrad's writing that's linked in some ways with his life as a mariner, as a mm-hmm. merchant seaman, mm-hmm. and the deep brooding philosophical pessimism in his work. Could you talk a little bit about that
yes.
element?
Yes. To give an illustration from another writer that I much admire, the French poet Ponge, and he explains that this attention to the mundane and the commonplace, and yet in a sense the universal, was it's as though if you know that there is an abyss ahead, you watch the railings and the steps that you're walking on with renewed care and attention. And I think that for Conrad it was a little about that. Let's say that he was really in some sense you could say a lost soul, if we think of how the terms of most people's lives or characters are dictated by having parents, having had a regular schooling, living in a familiar environment. None of these things had happened to him, nor had many of the ideas that he'd been brought up with as a Polish Catholic and not exactly nobleman, but at least having aristocratic in some sense. None of those things, as it were, gave any opportunity for daily life. So I think watching every step of the way and observing things with the fresh eye of somebody who's in that position made him, in a sense, love and treasure the mundane and the humdrum routine as something that stayed him from inner chaos, lack of certain direction in the future, that kind of thing. ¶¶
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Professor Ian Watt teaches literature at Stanford University. Professor Watt was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, where he discussed his critical work on the novelist Joseph Conrad. Ian Watt is the author of The Rise of the Novel, which examines the writing of Defoe, Richardson, and Fielding. He's written numerous articles and reviews on modern fiction, and he's recently published Conrad in the 19th Century. Joining in the discussion is Kent Mulliken, the Assistant Director of the National Humanities Center. Professor Watt, we're speaking to a general audience, and you speak obviously with great enthusiasm and relish for your topic, for Conrad. I wonder if you could just talk briefly about how one learns to do biography and criticism.
Well, it's like a lot of fundamental questions. I don't know what to say first. I can say honestly that I cannot remember any moment in my life where I did not think that one day I would write a book about Conrad. On the other hand, I can't really remember when I began writing it. But then that is that I suspect that my methods are not all that uncommon, but at least not the commonest, in that I did not start in the library. I started much more in reading the works of Conrad themselves and talking about them with people. I think more of one of the things with Conrad is that there are a lot of people who like Conrad who are not in the academy or even particularly literary. One of the first person I certainly spoke to about Conrad with any length was the local flour miller at Dover. And it may be that I began my interest in Conrad there. Then I think I had the, I do believe in chronology, so I certainly began with his birth when I came to write it. But I didn't have any very strict ideas of what was going to be in the book. I think a little in terms of the being somehow or other between me and Conrad and other human beings that I know. There is some common truth or picture or vision which writing is attempting to express, and it does it in a rather intuitive and unplanned way. The planning comes in the revision and thinking, well, is that really true to Conrad, or are these words really appropriate to me? Again, I've been thinking about Ponge, that somehow or other when I write about this, the idea is that people should be at ease in the book, both with me and with my subject and with themselves to some extent. Ponge's phrase is qu'on y soit à l'aise, that people should be at ease in the writing. And also, he says, qu'on y soit tout simple, without fussy manners, would be another thing. Mm. But the idea of thinking just what sort of shape I'm... Mm. It all began with interest and affection with the subject. Mm-hmm.
If I may ask another question about your own experience, your education was interrupted after your... undergraduate education, as we call it in this country, at St. John's College, Cambridge. You entered the military service in 1939, and for the next 7 years you were in the military, and you spent 3 years as a prisoner of war in the Far East, and then returned to scholarly life. During your period in the military, and especially as a prisoner of war, what did you think about it as a prisoner of war?
Well, one of the good things about being a prisoner of war, building the railway on the Kwai, was that one only thought, as it were, of the next step. I didn't really have any particular plan, especially as before the war there were almost no jobs in the academy.
I'd like to come back to Conrad for a moment. What is it that you find most appealing about Conrad the writer?
I think that having been a prisoner of war did give me an extra sense of how Conrad has a grown-up way of understanding the world. And it is the world of action. I don't mean the world of action of stirring adventures, but it is the world in which most people live. Let's say it is not so much the world of, the processes of worrying about your job or worrying about your love life or your worrying about your wife or worrying about your children. I mean, this is only part of it. It's also this sense he gives of men and women in a much larger picture. And therefore his particular concerns seem to me to reflect my sense of reality more, for example, than Joyce or Lawrence, both of whom are also admire writers that I love. But I don't find myself in them, my own experience of life at least, in them as much as I do in Conrad. So that I suppose I find what quite a lot of students, I think, now are looking for. Something you could call wisdom, to use a very old-fashioned term, in Conrad more than most writers. Of course, he's also a beautiful writer.
You are looking into the question of individualism. I understand that's one of your interests.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe that?
Yes. Well, for almost as long as I've been thinking of writing about Conrad, I've been thinking about writing about four myths: Faust, Don Juan, Don Quixote, as I call it, and Robinson Crusoe. And one of the common elements in this is that they are, I think, very widely known as examples or ego ideals of, in some way, the individual alone. What I'm interested in, particularly in my book, is that they all arose in a very different form, in which the story was intended, I think, to show how wicked it is and fruitless for people to try and set up entirely on their own. And they are all in different ways being punished. Even Robinson Crusoe, for example, isn't just having a ball with all his goats and parrots and cats. He's thinking he's being punished by God for having left his father and his homeland. And so I'm interested in the transformation of the idea of individualism, which is reflected in those myths, which was then given a new twist in the Romantic period, when our current very positive and approbative view of individualism came to the fore, and in which one sees how the reinterpretation of those myths all occurred at that time. Goethe's Faust would be the great example, the most famous example. And then I think that the subject has got a particular appeal today, when I think that the extent to which individualism depends upon, to some extent, coercive obstacles to be overcome, has become a less real issue, so that individualism no longer has that tempered in steel heroism which perhaps it had in people's earlier ideas of individualism.
I'm interested in your comments on Robinson Crusoe, which many readers, I suppose, have considered as a mere children's story. I'm interested in the ideas that you find implied by Defoe's telling of this this story, which, as I recall, is based on a real experience. Alexander Selkirk,
yes,
and all that.
But with Alexander Selkirk, there's no question that Robinson Crusoe and Alexander both saw it as a punishment. Why I think it became a myth is that in the later 18th century, when there was much greater interest in, first of all, in solitude, in the individual communing with himself, Rousseau tended to make Robinson Crusoe a figure of that kind of man who wants to be alone, far from the common crowd, as an ideal. This was one thing. The other is that our interest in the economic process and our interest in the basic relations of man to his physical environment means that Robinson Crusoe was seen as a recapitulation of man's success story, going up from sleeping in trees to sleeping in caves to learning some of the manual arts. And our educational ideas, of course, have very largely followed this idea, which was, of course, assisted by Rousseau, that what is most authentic involves the reaction to the environment, so that pottery and weaving and keeping pets and all those things became part of the what was thought of as the desirable experience for children's education, in a way, of course, which they never did in primitive societies, where, of course, you merely did it because that's what everybody did and they did very little else. In a sense, this has been reintroduced in the guise of education and hobbies. And it's been, therefore, of course, a way of, in a sense, getting back to things which primitive people pick up with every breath they take and everything they see in their daily lives. So that it's got this primitivist appeal.
Does Robinson Crusoe then, as you've suggested, become in a different way a representative economic man?
Yes. And of course, to some extent, he was meant to be representative of man isolated from God, or of being afraid of being isolated from God, so that the religious aspect, I mean, the idea that he had not thought enough about his religious duties is very important in the book. And it's very much there in the book, and that's one reason why many people have thought of Robinson Crusoe as being a particularly English or Puritan book. Buñuel's film of Robinson Crusoe, which isn't really, I think, very good, but it is very good in showing the fear of God and the fear of the devil as being primary elements in the story.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Please join us this week for Soundings, the Center's radio program. This week, Soundings brings you an interview with Professor Ian Watt of Stanford University, who will discuss modern fiction. Professor Watt was a prisoner of war in Southeast Asia, and he brings special insight to his recently published study of Joseph Conrad. Conrad was a writer whose themes emphasize freedom, moral captivity, and escape. Be sure to join us for Soundings.